it's my favorite game too right now. I'm totally obsessed with it, and I'm trying to exactly pinpoint what exactly it is about this game that makes it so not just compelling, but special in what it does that other games have failed to do or haven't attempted. And I don't know. I think it's something about the comprehensive nature of the game and the really enormous scope of it. It's so ambitious. Everything that you're seeking to model programmatically, I think there's something in that. And then so it's kind of got like this academic element to it. But then, of course, it's just fun because it's dwarves and hammers and, you know,
yeah, I mean, this is where, I mean, it's hard to even, I mean, I'm not good at articulating this, but this is where you start to see all the work with the small games come into play, like giving the dwarves names, all these little things that, I mean, they're part of the simulation, but that's not it. I mean, it has a bad interface or whatever, but there are a lot of little elements in there that are all just meant to push those buttons.
Right.
And it's not, I mean, it's not a cynical thing. It's just, that's just how it is. And we're pretty good at setting that kind of thing up. But, but there's the larger picture too, which kind of makes it feel like it's, I mean, I used to say when I was growing up that, you know, it was like, you know, I want to be able to make an addictive game or whatever. That's kind of happened, but it's like, if you want to make an addictive game, but now it's like I kind of devalue that now, because it's like, I mean, because I'm trying to put Dwarf Fortress against something like Bejeweled or something,
sure,
where someone can sit there, play it for 10 hours, and then how do they feel afterward? Well, I mean, hopefully they feel kind of drained and depressed and hate themselves, right? And I want people to come out of the Dwarf Fortress addictive state. And, you know, maybe their wife's gone or something, but they don't care because it was so fun.
Yeah.
It was cool, and they can think about it afterward and think that they didn't waste their time. And to have it actually be a kind of meaningful experience even. Yeah. So there's that where you can kind of it's hard to say when you've crossed that boundary from the kind of cynical, worthless, commercial addictiveness to something that's just part of the experience, but not something that you're approaching from that perspective.
I understand, and maybe that's it, and that's maybe why this game is compelling to the audience that it is because maybe especially you, Tom, because you had an academic career that you gave up to develop video games, and so that I think is representative of kind of this larger thing where video games are no longer kind of stigmatized in a way that they used to be as being, you know, childish or shallow or superficial or just masturbatory or all of those stigmas that went along with them. And now they're actually kind of being taken seriously as not only as serious entertainment, but as art, as simulations, as education, because they're effective and they're more effective than our older means of accomplishing those tasks. Maybe Dwarf Fortress is a really good example of more comprehensive simulations to come, and the idea of a comprehensive simulation being entertaining. I mean, those are really broad terms, but
yeah. And I've been talking to this guy who runs works on humanities simulations I think it's called the Digital Humanities Department or something at Stanford. And he's a fan, and wants to have us come down to a conference in California and stuff. And he said that basically the simulations they've got now seem kind of amateurish compared to Dwarf Fortress, which is very weird to me. I mean, it seems strange that's the state of the academic on this matter. But
well,
I'm not even sure where to begin on how you'd simulate or what they're simulating. I don't know the first thing about it, so. So I'm not sure where he's coming from, but there certainly is a lot of room to move there in terms of meaningful endeavors, I think, and more people. I mean, the fact that kind of department or program exists is a huge indicator of the seriousness with which things can be taken now. Mm-hmm. And not to mention the whole actual game studies, where you see these papers written about tellable moments. So someone wrote their MIT master's on Dwarf Fortress.
Oh, no kidding.
And the Dwarf Fortress community, you can find the paper on Reddit. I think it's Josh Diaz.
I'll write that down. I'll look it up.
I might have the first name wrong, but...
I'll look it up.
That's there. That's MIT
stuff?
Yeah, it's like 200 pages or something. It was interesting. And it's interesting to see all there's you know, probably a couple of decades now worth of academic jargon developed that I didn't understand what they were talking about some of the times, because they're just talking about like this paper on this and this and this. Uh-huh. And they've got this whole theory developed, and they've actually made some interesting little games. There's no big projects I'm aware of, but they make like these. So you have the old kind of space fighter game where you'd shoot lasers or whatever and just shoot opponents. But they had one where they would teach the projectiles could follow kind of a like a Crobots style script rule or whatever. You just have the script and then the bullet would do this, and they'd run thousands of simulations just changing the commands of how the bullets work, and they just let it run overnight and pick winners and losers, and then they tried to play against the computer or something after they were done, and the computer would come up with these guns that would fire like these they'd shoot forward, and then they'd come and make these tunnels for their ship to fly through and stuff. There's all this crazy, wow, crazy stuff. So they've done a lot of kind of interesting things that have come out of that thing. There are a lot of just outside of academics, there's all kinds of experimental game groups and stuff that I don't know much about, but there's a lot of interesting things going on at the periphery.
It's funny to think about Dwarf Fortress being on like the flavorful entertainment side of that world, and then you know, when it comes to like contemporary popular video games, it's obviously way on the opposite academic, you know, stark end of it. It's really fun. But it seems the reason it can occupy both spaces is because it does accommodate both of those things. I guess the first question, why dwarves, was really about that. And when I was playing it, I'm thinking, okay, they bury their dead. They have to. They don't eat intelligent creatures or butcher them. And so I'm thinking, like, the word that we have in English for that is humanity. And so, I mean, but they're not humans, they're dwarves. And so I'm thinking, like, why didn't they just make them humans?
I think it turns out, it, like we were saying, it was this completely unrelated kind of mutant miner slash Tolkien thing. I mean, because we wanted the fortress to always be destroyed, and of course you've got that Tolkien thing sitting right there where they always manage to dig too deep and die. But it turned out to be fortuitous, because dwarves are seen as flawed humans in a way. They can be over emotional. They can have weaknesses to drink and so on more than people do, and so every time there's a bug or just something like that, it can just be attributed to dwarfness.
It's the dwarfness.
And that was completely fortuitous. That was not a planned thing, but now people have. I mean, we're doing, you know, as much as anybody now to kind of define what it is to be a dwarf.
I think so. Yeah.
And we've. You know, dwarves are a bit more popular now with people. Because I remember seeing some people send an email. They're like, you know, I always used to play elves and when I was an adventurer, and I always liked elves, but now I'm a dwarf person. And it's like people are kind of finally going with the dwarf.
Yeah, and it suits the game in kind of a weird way, because, like, those things that you were saying about on other message boards, the critiques, like the superficial dismissal of Dwarf Fortress, it's clunky, it's hard, it's toil, it takes a lot of work. And I'm like, these are things that dwarves are drawn to. It requires someone fond of industry to enjoy Dwarf Fortress as a game. So it's kind of got this kind of congruence. You have to kind of be a dwarf to enjoy Dwarf Fortress a little bit. You have to be kind of masochistic, kind of obsessed, kind of like way too into work for work's sake.
Yeah.
All these things. Like, it's kind of congruent a little bit.
Well, the number of people that come to the little fan meetups we've had, they were both down in Seattle right here, beards are popular.
Yeah, I'll bet. Yeah, I could see that. Well, I mean, you're sitting in front of it for 10 hours a day. I mean, you know...
who has time to shave? I don't remember.
I mean, I can barely even make soap. It's like my lowest priority, let alone using it. I mean, it's just sitting there. Well, that's all the questions I had. I mean, I could sit here and praise you guys for another 3 hours if you wanted, but I mean, I wrote all this on a plane. I guess the losing is fun thing, is that yours or is that from the fan community?
That's ours. We put that in there, and that was one of the things that was deliberate. We want people to understand that the game, especially later, somewhat now, but especially later, is only going to be enriched by your failure. You know, if having an abandoned fortress, there's not going to be one until you put one there.
Right.
And you know, World Gen might have some, but they're not going to be half as interesting as what you put there yourself. Mm-hmm. And you can't avenge your adventure unless you have an adventurer get killed by somebody. And you're never going to see, you know, half the game eventually unless you're willing to embrace defeat, not restore old saves. I mean, people will still do it, but and it's fine because sometimes you want to get the thing right or whatever. But that's just getting people acclimated to that kind of thinking is, and it is just kind of fun to watch things fall apart.
Yeah, it is. I don't know. I mean, I struggled with it. I don't know what the term is where you take a backed up save and you play it.
Save scumming.
Yes,
or?
That.
Yeah,
I was guilty of that at first. Okay, they have names and they have traits. You watch them develop. You build their fucking bedrooms. You know, you clothe them, you bathe them, you train them, and then they grow up and they defend themselves, and you're so proud of them, and then they get butchered. It's horrifying. It's horrifying. I had no conception of how realistic the violence was going to be at this point either. So it was really traumatic. And so to be able to undo that was nice, and I wasn't able to appreciate. It was also prior to the most recent posterior to the most recent update. So the gathering up when I would reclaim, it was less efficient than the current version about gathering all the stuff that was scattered everywhere.
I think something with that changed because when the night creatures went in, because they needed their little hovels are filled with stuff from the beginning of time or whatever. And some of the original bugs I was having when you visit a night creature's lair is there'd just be gore scattered all over the place. And their cauldron would be in outside or something. It just scattered everywhere. And so I tightened that down, and I don't know if that incidentally tightened down the dwarf mode stuff. I think it did. Yeah, I think it did. I think there was some other stuff I was thinking about, because there was also a reclaim bug where if you abandon your fortress while a dwarf is doing a job with an item, that item would retain the flag on it that says I'm being used. And so when you reclaim the fortress, there's this item that you can't move or touch or do anything with. And when I cleaned that up, I went through the item code. I probably changed a lot of stuff. That tends to happen.
Wow. So this is kind of like a shop question, I guess. But, I mean, with the enormous complexity and the tremendous scope, how do you decide what to work on and in which order?
We just talk about it, right? We're like, what do we want to, and it changes.
Next?
Yeah, it just changes from, I mean, we have this giant, we used to have, and it's still up there, that big dev page with all the wrecks, bloats, and core items. You probably found that. Giant 5,000 things or whatever, right? Or not 5,000, but almost like 1,000 things or something. And that was getting unwieldy. And especially as a public document, it's like, you know, people are like, you're going to do this, and this soon, right? And so we reduced it down to the current smaller dev page. But even that, it's like, you know, we don't work that fast. And so we want to work on interesting things. What interests us changes from time to time. And so we just don't try and pin ourselves to anything. Just talk about it. And we'll be planning something out. We're going through big planning sessions about, you know, what's coming up in adventure mode or how the armies are going to work, how the merchants are going to work, that kind of thing. Okay. And then what's after that? We don't have it planned after that. The caravan arc stuff, bug fixes, army arc, that is the current plan. And everything else, it's like we don't know if we're going to do exploring or dungeons or thievery or infiltration of places with the hero, go back and do the hauling and stuff that won the Eternal Suggestion voting. like carts and yeah. things, easy not to do, but because it's the most mundane kind of thing.
Right.
Especially after this current release of just doing caravan economy stuff, it'd be good to stay away from that for a little while. Mm. But I'm not sure. It could be the next thing. It just depends on where we're at.
Well, this series is also kind of unique, but maybe that kind of convention about like an ongoing, perpetual refinement and development as a cultural artifact. Like, I guess that kind of goes on. And I'm really not familiar with like tabletop role playing or card games and things like that. But it seems like that's the only other form of entertainment that's constantly understood to be undergoing constant, perpetual refinement.
I guess maybe like superhero cartoon comic books or something, right? They kind of keep going.
They have like this canon allegiance thing, right? Like where you can't
until you officially reboot or something like that. There's a lot of
they just don't have the narrative thing to worry about.
Yeah, it's completely different, but it's similar in maybe that respect. Yeah. I was just trying to fish around for similarities. Yeah, it's hard to think of something.
Earlier you mentioned like D&D. I'm not super familiar with it. Like that's also kind of undergoing refinement always, right?
Well, arguably, there's always fights about every edition. I dropped out 10 years ago or something like that. I don't remember when, and more than that probably. 1996 was the last time I played a game, I think. They're constantly revising rules and so on. It's always kind of the same setting, and they just add some rules and subtract some rules, change some things around, and they do it. I'd call it more like a sequel, though. It's like it's like saying Doom 2, Doom 3, Doom 4, that kind of refinement, because there's second edition, third edition, 3.5, whatever. I don't know why they put a decimal in there. Someone knows. And then there's version 4, I guess, just came out. And so it's like, and then there's branches. Mm-hmm. And that would be similar to having like a Descent come off of Doom or something like that. And then you'd have, so it's similar to that. I mean, having a Dwarf Fortress style monstrosity is not uncommon. It's a roguelike tradition in part. NetHack is still in development as far as I know.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, they have a dev team. I forgot where they are, University of Wisconsin or something. I really have no idea. It's probably worldwide now or whatever. But they don't work that much. But they occasionally will put out a release, and that game has been ongoing for a couple decades or whatever. Stone's Dungeon Crawl is still in development, and that kind of wasn't in development for a while, and then it got re-picked up by people, and they just add stuff to it. And NetHack has a billion branches. There was Slash and Slash EM or Slash'em for Slash is for super lots of added stuff hack, and then the Slash'em is super lots of added stuff hack with extended magic, and they just keep adding stuff on
there.
So
the acronym also reflects the kind of bloating.
There's a tradition of kind of creeping specifications and just doing what you want, because these are like mostly dev team / one person projects, these little little groups just adding stuff. And so Dwarf Fortress is similar to that. We've kind of, I mean, I don't know how much they have an overarching perspective of what they want to do. And we've been trying to keep that, but within the confines of the little bubble. Pretty much the only thing, and we've failed at times with this, and sometimes we haven't, is just to try and keep it coherent and fun. Because that's the thing. It's like you could add some random thing now, but it might not be the best thing to add based on what criteria.
Like there's a million criteria.
Yeah. Just, I mean, you could spend a lot of time making the sewage thing, and I mean that would add something to the game. But is it the right thing to do? We thought, there are a lot of times you have to consider the prerequisite things. Like you can't do the army arc before the caravan arc. I mean, you can, but you're going to have to rewrite a lot of stuff because there's supplies to be considered. There's why do you attack one point or another if you don't even know how much stuff is at either place, right? Now everything's quantified. Right. Everything's quantified.
Develop, you're also... Yeah. Like you're better at kind of anticipating future work.
That in particular is something I've been working on for a long time. That's pretty much every. I mean, I don't have a lot of finished projects. I have a graveyard of maybe over 1,000 games, and when I say games, I mean it loosely. You don't have 1,000 good games or 1,000 things. You have these little basic files where someone runs around or something, and there's literally 1,000 of those things. And you just learn to adapt to impending failure. And it's gotten to the point now where Dwarf Fortress is basically unscuttleable. It's going to keep going. Armok, the one right before it, run into the ground to die. And I was learning, all these learning experiences in the past. And now I feel like, part of it's just, something where a programmer, like an actual programmer, unlike myself, would scoff at, because they'd be like, well, if you use proper object-oriented programming technique, then you're never going to have this problem, because your program will be infinitely extendable. It's not true. It doesn't work out that way. But but that's the philosophy. And I've picked up some of those things. But some of it is from more of a design perspective, where you've got to learn to predict what you're going to need, and you have to program it with future improvements, not just in the technical kind of like you can extend this object properly or whatever, but conceptually it's going to be the way you want to go. And there's a lot of failure to do that, or just not anticipating things. Because all of our workshops are probably going to get reworked as custom workshops in the ROS. Mm-hmm. Of course, it would have been better to start that way, and you got people chirping at you all the time saying, oh, you should have just put it in the ROS to begin with, but it doesn't work that way.
Right.
You don't know what you're going to do, or you can't plan everything out ahead of time. It's just like the random creatures. You've got these random creatures. They should be sitting in the ROS with, some kind of script language telling you how to build them, but they're all hard-coded right now because they don't know what we need. And it's easier to work with things in hard-coded, because once you get the ROS format, once you have a raw format, you're more married to it, and it's harder to change. So it'd be premature to get them out there. I was kind of hoping the first random creatures to get out into the raws would be something like dragons, where there's an overall idea of a dragon, but there are all kinds of tweaks.
Right.
All kinds of tweaks, like number of heads, or how many legs does it have, can it talk, and all that kind of stuff. Kind of all different forms of dragon. And, if you really want to split hairs, there's already procedural elements in the ROS, because you can choose the colors from a list. You can put a giant list of colors, and they'll be this color or that color, this color, that color, that
kind of thing. Like the way that Forgotten Beasts work, and, like, their traits.
Yeah. The way Forgotten Beasts right now, the way they work, is it actually generates a raw file and then processes it. So it's kind of halfway there. It just needs kind of the script that generated that raw file, which is just the code. So there's hardly a difference. I just don't know much about scripting languages, and actually going in and putting like Lua in the game or whatever. You know, is that the big question there? Actually, someone else brought this up. I didn't even think of this at first. Is the second you put a scripting language in the game that has all the variables, kind of a Turing complete kind of scripting languages with ifs and variables and else's and for loops and all that kind of, you've just made the game massively unmoddable for a whole lot of people. Right now the modding is pretty simple. It's just these text files with tags. And but if you force people to learn to program, then it's only programmers that are going to be modding. And that's not good. So I don't know where, see, that's kind of weird then, because I don't know if I can ever say the Forgotten Beasts are going to be moddable or not, or to what extent they'll be moddable. That would be one of those design things. Like, I don't know yet.
It's also begs that same old question about how allegiant you are to your fan contributions. And because every time you update, they've got to figure out what updates you made, and then they have to,
I guess I've got that down to a science now, scanning for memory addresses and figuring out where they are. Because Stone Sense is updated within like 8 hours of the release now,
really?
Or whatever. They just
makes sense.
Yeah, no. Well, they're. I get the impression some of the better hackers in the world sometimes are working on our stuff or whatever. And it's like, because the guy that did the graphics, update the SDL guy, Bon. I don't know if you're familiar with him, but there's an SDL and then a regular legacy version.
Mm-hmm.
The legacy version is my stuff. The SDL it's a Linux and Mac support is much easier there, and it sped up the OpenGL code on a lot of computers.
Okay.
That was written by somebody else, because I am not familiar with modern graphics stuff. And that guy is very proficient, and it just, you know, after that he got a job at Google or whatever. It was funny, I did the phone interview. I was like his job reference. I talked to this woman on the phone about what he was doing or whatever, and he was really good. He's a better programmer than I am anyway. And so there are a lot of really talented people working on it. I mean, it's probably the same type of people that have, like, you know, the next biggest game cracked a week before it comes out or whatever. Those kind of people are very good at hacking games. It was weird to hear people talking about, like, the machine code of Dwarf Fortress, reading the .exe file, and they're like, yes, I can tell that you did this here. It's like they just read it or whatever. It's very weird. I can't do that. I had one guy go on the forum once and it was like, kind of dress me down for some random thing I did in the code. He's like, you shouldn't have done that here or whatever. I'm like, what are you talking about? It's like, look at the machine code here. Look at this or whatever. I was like, yeah, I don't know. I can't do anything for him. But so there's a lot of really technically proficient people hanging out on the boards. So they'll find a way to mod it. I mean, they'll probably just make, if I don't have a Forgotten Beast generator, they'll probably just write one or whatever. Because I think there already are mod, like generators for creatures to some extent. Because you just need to generate the text file, right? So you could write a whole third-party application that creates creatures and could have a whole menu and stuff. And yeah, it's pretty moddable. At least the content's moddable.
My conception of when I was writing the questions was probably then kind of backwards, because I was wondering, like, to what extent are you willing to accommodate them? But the question more seems like they're just going to follow you no matter where you go, and they're going to be able to disassemble and dissect the game and get what they want from it, no matter whether you give it to them or not.
Yeah, this is not, I mean, there's the actually reverse engineering the entirety of the code, from what I gather from these people who are proficient, would be, one person described it as a 2-year autistic project for one version of the game. So it's just not something, because at least there's safety in that sense. While we continue to develop the game, we could only get scooped by ourselves from 2 years ago,
yeah,
which is a long time. So if someone puts out, I mean, so someone could very well be sitting on the code from 2 years ago,
mm-hmm,
and release it or do whatever, and it, you know, I don't know what that would do. That's why it's not an open source game. I mean, there's that whole question, right? Like, why isn't this an open source game? You're taking donations, and
mm-hmm,
it's a roguelike tradition to some extent to open source your game and so on. And you know, really, the answer is it's basically like the poop thing or whatever. It's like, mm-hmm, what will happen? I don't know. Is that a good decision? Seems like a decision that involves a lot of uncertainty.
Yeah. Well, the game occupies such a unique place right now in the landscape of options. It's a very unique place. I mean, so to disclose all of these things publicly, you'd have not just fan-made content for your game, but derived
forks, lots of forks. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. There'd be a ton of forks, and then where do we fit into that mix?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, people are quick to, like, if someone were to reskin it and just kind of improve the interfaces and not do anything else,
mm-hmm,
that person would probably be a much more financially successful person than we are. I mean, it's essentially what's been done with some of these other projects or whatever, if you consider, like, Minecraft, for example.
Right.
It's a simple, I mean, the guy said we were one of his big inspirations or whatever.
I played it,
and of course that's a very successful game.
Yeah, well, extremely. I mean, I'm a really unsuccessful video game developer. I've only been doing it for a very, very short period of time, about 2 years. And when I heard these numbers that were coming out from Minecraft about how much money they were making, I was like, oh, shit. Now we're going to have tons of competition. Like, everybody's going to be getting into this weird nonsense of that it's going to become so overpopulated and devalued, and I'm going to have some really great overqualified competition. I'm never going to be able to sink.
Yeah, of course, from the other perspective, I mean, he was diving into this kind of MMO kind of market, which is already massively oversaturated. So
sure. There's
always room for people with, I mean, I hesitate to call it a fresh idea just because of where it came from. But from the perspective of everyone who doesn't like text, you know, pretty fresh idea. I guess you have to have give Infiniminer. I don't remember which one came first, but Infiniminer was the other game that that ripped off of. I think it was the first one that kind of did the 3D mining picture or whatever like that. I don't really remember that. But
I'm sorry to interrupt. I just now realized, though, that in my vocabulary of successful indie games, I'm thinking about like Minecraft, of course, and Braid, which you mentioned, but also like Spelunky is really highly regarded.
Yeah, Derek Yu does a lot of
games. But I'm thinking like Minecraft, Spelunky, and Dwarf Fortress are all about subterranean mining and exploration, and each one of those games has a pick.
I don't think Spelunky had anything explicitly to do with Dwarf Fortress. That guy's a fan.
Sure.
Derek, I know you play the game. You want to make a poster for our game or something. But that seems more based on. He's been doing a lot of games. He seems to like this kind of roguelike thing, though, because he just put out Desktop Dungeons. I don't know if you saw that.
I did. Yeah, well, he did a tile set for it, right?
Yeah, it said by Derek Yu at the bottom of it. I don't know why it says that on there. But it's another one of these roguelike themed games that they seem to be into over there. Because he was mostly doing platformers earlier. Well, I guess Spelunky's still a platformer.
Yeah.
But it's a roguelike platformer.
I like Spelunky a lot for just the same. I mean, it's fun. But also that it's procedurally generated within really well-finessed parameters. It's random, but it's also always beatable. There's always a path to the bottom. You can always win. It's going to be hard, varyingly hard, but it's always beatable.
Yeah, no, it's a skill that you work on over a long kind of period of tweaking. I mean, it's basically probably was written like any of those other things. The first levels look like crap, and then you just work on it over and over, just like World Gen, right? That's just the product of a couple months of. Just changing and changing and changing and changing and changing until it looks right.
So here's a totally unrelated question. But do either of you have a background in geology or like an uncle who's a geologist or something?
No, I just had these gem books that were cool.
I feel like I'm being educated against my will when I play Dwarf Fortress about sedimentary layers and
we did put in the legwork kind of studying that stuff when we put it in, and it's like I'm just kind of on Wikipedia all the time reading about stuff. I learned about press cakes and pomace or whatever. I didn't know pomace was the word for crushed apples and olives after they've been milled, and then you can use that to feed animals and make cheap wine for your slaves if you're Roman or whatever. So there's all this kind of stuff. It's like I'm just constantly picking crap up like that now. Whatever the next thing's going to be, and we'll be learning about clay a little bit, I guess.
Spent days and days researching medieval town life for the...
Yeah, so much of that stuff.
For the towns that are coming in with this next one.
I can't wait. Yeah. I can't wait. I mean, that's the thing with this being ongoing, is I think of it now as being comprehensive and very immersive and realistic. And then when I hear, about you can shear sheep now and there's going to be vegetable oil. God, I'm never going to get away from this fucking game.
That's right.
I'm never going to get away from
it. Capture them and we take them and we pull them.
That's right. It's terrifying. Originally I had the question, no unusual flora, because I thought all plant life was from the real world, but... Since played enough games to realize that's not entirely.
Yeah, it was weird how that turned out. The trees are all, except in the good and evil and underground, the trees are all real life trees. The plants, none of them were except for strawberries, I think. And that was just a random decision. And now the 18 grasses or whatever that are coming in, I didn't know anything about grasses because apparently all these grasses out here have names, right? Of course you knew that, but you didn't think about it.
No.
And so I added all the different types of grasses, and now coming back, I feel like I want the plants to be all real world plants too, except out on the periphery again, underground, in good and evil places, in these savage places, and that's just kind of a stepping stone again toward starting with familiarity and then moving to random generation.
Got it.
putting in stuff that is kind of like a stock creature, you need some of that stuff. Like, we have these weird things like stranglers and stuff that live in the jungle. And but we're not wedded to those things very much. And you see how creative we normally are. We just take an animal, put man after it, right? The animal mans, the animal peoples.
Well, I don't know. It's hard for me. I guess when I'm playing it, if I can extract myself enough and remember that it's been developed by humans, I guess I think, like, I ran into a jabberer for the first time. And I was thinking, like, first of all, like, what a horrifying concept. Something about beaks just really gets to me. I don't know what it is. But then I was thinking, okay, so this must be something from fiction or fantasy that I haven't encountered. It's from a book or a comic book or a card, you know, something that I haven't seen yet, or a game. And so I'm never willing to give YouTube credit ever for something like that, but it's not, I'm not, like, conscious of it. I think that this game is the whole landscape of, you know, fantasy, and I never think that of original contribution.
Yeah, I think, we almost did that, like, procedural generation, because we each just took a tablet, and we're, like, sitting in these two chairs, and we're like, okay, draw as many creatures as you can. And so we drew 10 pages of creatures apiece, and then we picked the ones that we thought looked the best and gave them names. We're like, give it a name, give it a name, give it a name, and then we came up with the stories afterward. And that's where the Jabberer came from.
I like the verb-er format, because it seems like realistic to the way that dwarves and dwarven culture would refer to them, right? Because, you know, this is what you do, you just quickly, like, soldiers and things are similar. I've been studying war slang recently, and it's similar. Like, when they talk about tools or creatures or people, you know, they the name is what it does. And so I think about it, it's appropriate in a weird way. And that adds to the spookiness of it, because, like, the...
I was trying to think if there are any real world birds that are like that. Warbler is the only one that comes to the top of my mind.
Right.
And warbles.
Well, there's, like, colloquial names for them, but the actual, like, scientific academic name would not be that.
I'm not sure. Have you ever imagined a jabber jabbering?
It could. it's best to leave it in the mind of the...
Yeah, well, it works. It got to me for some reason. The beak, I think, and it being huge. And
yeah, I think his picture of it. I think Zach drew that one, and it was this big, two-legged, bird. It's a bird, but the beak was like this, pointing down, and there was a little person standing there.
Oh man, I don't know why that bugged me so much. So it's also the idea that they live their entire lives subterraneously is also very alien and effective. I don't know. Moving on. But I guess I should probably disclose I've only encountered just a taste that there is something more to it than just the simulation, and there's, like, some awful, horrifying things to come, but I haven't encountered those things yet.
It's possible.
Yeah, so I guess I should just disclose that, not that I want to hear about it, but just so you know where I'm at.
We're at it. I mean, yeah, well, I guess if you read the devlog, there's new horrifying grasses now for you to experience as well.
Okay, can't wait. I brought up the unusual flora thing. It seems to me, in my limited experience of the game, that there's no fantasy realm geology that's going, so except...
Adamantine.
Yes! Except for that, are there any fictional rocks?
No, that was. There's one more. There's one more. You'll find it.
Oh,
No big deal. but it's. I don't know if that was something I was always thinking of, rather than exploring with some stock ones first, kind of how we're doing the monsters. Like, the new critter will have a new tag, and that'll be used in the random generation or whatever. I was thinking maybe we would just kind of do that cold, just if we're going to generate some rocks. Because, I mean, fantasy rocks are always called, like, black rock or something anyway.
Yeah, it's
right?
A colloquial name, yeah.
Yeah, so it's just...
Whereas, like, the real ones have kind of this Latin...
And so one of the few times we used a place name, because we try and stay away from calling something like a like a Bactrian camel, for instance, because it calls up a real world location. But we have Alexandrite, which calls up either a person or a location. I'm not sure which one. And it both, I guess, because the location came from the person many times. But I mean, Alexandrias are there in the world. Yeah. But I don't remember where I was going with that.
The names of generating the names of fictional rocks. Is that it?
Maybe, I don't know. But there's some reason why
the names of the rocks. You don't want to call it Alexandrite because it's a person's name, so you'd rather call it something.
Yeah, but I left Alexandrite in. I don't remember why. Well, I guess I didn't care at the time. But yeah, I left all the other, like the other one. I mean, we mostly hear them called guinea pigs, but some people call them cavies. I'm not sure what you've heard.
Right.
And so we I believe we went with cavy just because it doesn't have guinea in it. Although there was no way to avoid guinea eventually because we wanted to add many domestic animals for next time.
Mm-hmm.
The guinea fowl is the most, I think, one of the most domesticated birds in the world just because India and China are in on the act or whatever. And so there's guinea fowl in the game. I looked all over for another name. There's no other name. They're guinea fowl. That's all they are. And so, I mean, we could go back and have guinea pigs, but there's no reason to relate them. So we just have cavies because one of the name was available.
Forgotten beasts that attacked was a cavie. and so I had to look it up because I'd only heard them called guinea pigs.
Yeah, we hadn't heard. When did we first hear a cavie?
Probably went to the county fair or something.
Yeah, it's not. Yeah, I think it's more of a fair type term.
Well, 4-H.
Like 4-H. 4-H.
I thought it was a colloquial thing because it's in a cave. It comes from a cave. It's a cavey something. So I thought it was a colloquial name. Which I don't even know if that name originates in English or not. Does it?
Also the Y. So it's
yeah.
It's the Y. It doesn't sound like.
Yeah, I don't know.
Well, that's it. That's all my questions. That's all I've got. Thanks for indulging me. This was great. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, it's always fun to do stuff like this. We just need to get out of the house sometimes.
Yeah.